Rabbi Zev Baron, who is not here today, for its continuous sponsorship of Torah for Tycoons. Torah for Tycoons is celebrating its bar mitzvah year. 13 years we've been gathering people here for lunch and learning. Throughout the past 12 seasons, the Kollel has brought the Torah perspectives on business and personal ethics to well over 500 people through this program. The next class will be on Wednesday, December 7th. Topic and presenter have not yet been finalized. If you have ideas, send them to Rabbi Fleischer. Some of you may have heard about our recently launched capital campaign as the Kollel embarks on creating infrastructure in multiple locations across Denver. If you'd like more information for dedication opportunities, please speak to a Kollel rabbi following the class. If you've missed past T for T classes, you may want to listen to the recordings. You can find them on the Kollel's website, www.denverkollel.org. You can also find the latest info on Kollel programming and archive classes on many topics on the website. For the sake of Shalom Bayit, there'll be no World Series of our political discussions today. Now I'd like to introduce today's presenters. Our guest speaker is the Honorable David Richmond, Judge of the Colorado Court of Appeals, and Rabbi Mordechai Fleischer, senior educator for the Denver Community Kollel. And we will start with his honor.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Rabbi Fleischer tells me I'm supposed to talk for only about 10 minutes, so I'll try to do this as quickly as I can.
We're not going to throw you out if you will.
I have the presentation in front of me. The copy of the presentation is in this document. Everybody should have it. If they have a few extras here, anybody need it, you can follow it here, or we're going to do it with the PowerPoint up on the wall, be really sophisticated, jump into the 21st century. I'm sorry it reads a little downhill. When we get to the Hebrew, it'll read a little uphill, but that's okay. All right. In Deuteronomy, in Parshat Shoftim, we read some of the main primary Torah laws, primary verses about the system of justice. We just read it a few weeks ago. Shoftim v'shotri, titein lecha v'kol sharecha, asher Hashem elokecha noten lecha. You should have officers and you should have judges in all of your gates, in all of your cities. That Hashem gives to you, amongst your tribes, shaftu et ha'am, and they should judge the people, mishpat tzedek, with righteous justice. The next verse, this is one of the key ones from my talk, lo tite mishpat, don't tilt justice, lo takir panim, don't respect faces, don't recognize faces, we'll understand that in a little bit. Lo tikak shochet, don't take a bribe. Rabbi Fleischer got a brilliant talk on what shochet means. Because the bribe blinds the eyes of the wise, or the eyes of the judges. Yislapi writes at the key, and it perverts the words of the righteous. Tzedek tzedek tzedu, the verse we all know, justice justice we shall pursue, l'mat yeh v'rashta ta'aret, in order that you will inherit the land, asher Hashem elokechem noten lach, that God gives to you. Primary verses in the Torah, written we don't know when, 3,000 years ago, maybe more. Today, these are still incorporated in the ethical principles that judges such as myself have to follow, okay? It may be, I think, that that verse that says blind justice actually comes out of that verse. And I just want to point something out to you for today's class. Colorado State Court judges, such as myself, are governed by a code of judicial conduct. And in a second, we're going to look at some of the applications. They're also judges of the federal court. They're governed by a different, slightly different code of conduct. And the question that some people want to talk about is, what about the Supreme Court justices? Rabbi Fleischer threw out the idea, what about what Justice Ginsburg had said about a certain candidate for president, which she later took back, of course. We'll look at the ethical rules that apply to that in a minute. Very quickly, we can't make that bigger. I don't know if you can read that. These are some of the key provisions from the Colorado Code of Judicial Conduct govern judges like me, state court judges. We have to maintain our impartiality. We have to avoid impropriety. One of the key ones is, excuse me, is that we must avoid conduct that would create in reasonable minds the perception that the judge violates the code or adversely reflects on the judge's honesty, impartiality, temperament. And we also know that a judge should perform his duties impartially. He shall not be swayed by public clamor or fear of criticism, shall not permit family interests to get in the way, just paraphrasing, and he shall not make public statements on the merits of matters pending before the judge. Canon 4, state court judges now. State court judges cannot make speeches for political organizations or candidates or publicly endorse or oppose candidates for public office. But Justice Ginsburg is a federal judge, not a state court judge. These are some of the provisions from the Code of Conduct, which are spell out in a little bit more detail what we have to follow. A very important one is that the judge cannot sit in a case if he's related to a party, whatever that means, and he cannot sit in a case where he has an economic interest. Why am I pointing these principles out to you? Remember them, because in a few minutes, you're going to be the judge in three hypothetical cases, not hypothetical, actual cases. You'll have to tell us how you would decide them. Now, the federal judges have a slightly different code of federal conduct, judicial conduct. Theirs reads, the appearance of impropriety occurs when reasonable minds conclude honesty, integrity, and partiality are impaired. Remember, the other ones is what reasonable minds would maybe think that. This is a little different. Judges of the federal court must perform their duties fairly, impartially, diligently. And again, no public comment on matters pending before the court. And federal judges must refrain from political activity. They cannot make speeches for political organizations or candidates or publicly endorse or oppose candidates for public office. Exactly the same language that applies to the state court judges. Does that govern Judge Justice Ginsburg's conduct? Well, we'll see in a minute. The Federal Code of Judicial Conduct also has more specific canons, very similar to the ones that are in the State Court of Conduct Code. If in the Federal Code of Conduct, there's this very important sentence, I put it in quotes because it's so crucial. This Code of Conduct applies to United States Circuit Judges. I'm standing in front of you, I'm sorry. United States Circuit Judges, District Judges, Court of International Trade Judges, Federal Claims Judges, Bankruptcy Judges, and Magistrate Judges. Those of you who are lawyers, I'm sure it jumps out at you, which kind of judges are missing from the list? Supreme Court justices are not explicitly governed by the Federal Code of Judicial Conduct. What code are they governed by? None. There is none. There is no code of conduct that expressly applies to the Supreme Court justices. But there is a statute. 28 U.S.C. 455, for those of you who are into the details, is a federal statute. And it says it provides for the disqualification of, and this is the heading, justice, judge, or magistrate. Therefore, a justice or a judge could be disqualified or should disqualify if they have a personal bias or prejudice, knowledge of the facts, served with a lawyer, has a relative in the case, or has a person within a third degree relationship who is likely to be a material witness. Again, none of those necessarily, those don't address Justice Ginsburg's conduct. They might address Justice Scalia's conduct when he stood on a case with his hunting partner, who, whatever. Okay, that was a while ago. Doesn't matter now, I guess, because he's no longer around.
Can't prosecute him.
Can't do anything today. So, the way it works is, state court judges follow the Colorado Code of Judicial Conduct. Federal judges, the Federal Code of Judicial Conduct. But the Supreme Court justices have no written code of conduct because they're not on it, although they could be disqualified. So what's the deal? So, I looked this up. The Supreme Court does not have a code of judicial conduct. It's a bit of a misnomer. But although it does not govern, Chief Justice Roberts said in a 2011 speech, and you have it in front of you, I'm not going to read it all to you, although there is a movement to get the Supreme Court to be bound by a code of judicial conduct, he opposes it because The judges of the Supreme Court can't be judged by anybody except themselves. Who is to review their conduct? They have to make their own decision when they are recused from a case, and if they have a conflict of interest, there's no court to decide whether it is a situation where they have to be ordered to recuse themselves. Be that as it may, Justice Roberts insists, and it's seen in his remarks, that the Supreme Court follows the Code of Federal Judicial Conduct on a voluntary basis. So, that's the structure. Any questions so far? Okay, I want to go on. You be the judge, okay? You guys have to, now you got to earn your lunch, okay? You got to talk a little here. Case number one. Ready? You've got to apply the rules. A federal appellate judge is presiding over a creditor's appeal of a decision in a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The debtor has many unsecured creditors, one of which is AT&T. Remember, that was a phone company once upon a time. Some of you, I'm sure, remember that, right? To which the debtor has an unpaid bill of $500, okay? In other words, a company that's in bankruptcy has unpaid debt. The unsecured creditors will take nothing under the reorganization plan, but the appellate judge owns stock in AT&T. Does the federal appellate judge have to recuse himself? Should he recuse himself? What do you think? What other facts might you want to know to decide this case? There's a lot of lawyers, right? Lawyers who want to know more facts. No? Should this judge recuse himself because he owns stock in AT&T, which is a creditor of the debtor, and AT&T's $500 bill might be what's called crammed down, right? They take it away in the reorganization. Should the judge recuse himself? Yes?
First of all, you probably have the materiality standard. It's such a minor fraction. It probably wouldn't apply. However, it still would have the appearance of impropriety.
It would have the appearance of impropriety. The judge sits okay. So if you were the appellate judge, you would recuse yourself.
Yes.
Anybody have a difference of opinion? Judge Jones? Judge Jones of my court is with us today, too. He always has an opinion.
No, I don't think it's an appearance of impropriety because I think, as I recall, the test is a reasonable person, what a reasonable person would think. And this judge's stock value is not going to be affected at all by a $500 claim and a $12 billion company. So I don't think a reasonable person would question is impartial.
What do you say to that?
I would say, well, people read in the newspapers, they read the judge owns shares in AT&T, they will not necessarily know if it's such a fractional interest, and therefore, it would still have the appearance of impropriety.
Even if it says the judge owns just 200 shares? But it
not enough people would read that small.
Okay. The judge, back to you.
I think the standard assumes that a reasonable person knows the facts.
Okay. Anybody else?
Patty? No? Both? One thing I'd like to know is what does the $500 bill represent in the total amount of unsecured debt? If that is de minimis, along with his stock being de minimis, I think, you know, it is not really, you know, giving an appearance of impropriety that, you know, AT&T lost out on $5.
Right. It's not going to matter that much to them. Well, the creditor's not going to get that much of an advantage.
Right.
They're getting rid of $500.
Right.
Okay. That's a good point.
I question that. In this case, the decision-making might affect other cases that will get bigger regarding this industry.
How?
Precedent. If we show that this is so, if that continues,
if the judge announces that he recused himself in a small case like this, that might have a precedential.
No, the other way around. The court. What is the court case going to be? The decision of the court. The decision of that case won't become precedent for other cases that might impact AT&T.
Possibly. But the judge's decision on refusal is not likely to be very well publicized. That's what he said. I mean, it might be. I don't know. It's a federal appellate judge. Well, we should move on. Folks, this was a real case, okay? When I was a law clerk to a Tenth Circuit judge, he faced this issue. And what did he do? Much to my surprise, he recused himself. He recused himself. He was so impeccably concerned about his ethical appearance. And I'm going to let Rabbi Fleischer talk about that. Maybe you want to do it now, or do you want to come back after that?
Let's finish all three.
The cases. There is actually some interesting Torah law that would apply to that kind of a situation. Let's go to case two. A federal trial court judge is presiding over a lawsuit in which the defendant alleges a breach of contract and a violation of the covenant not to compete. I'm assuming people know what that is. The plaintiff said that the defendant went into business in competition with him. The defendant is a Jewish person who has a 15-year-old son. You guys are going to like this one, okay? Shortly before trial, the plaintiff, the lady who's the person who's bringing the lawsuit, filed a motion under that statute I showed you to recuse the judge. Why? Because the judge had attended the son's bar mitzvah service at the local synagogue. Thus, the motion alleged, the judge has a personal bias in favor of the defendant. In other words, the mother of the bar mitzvah. Okay? The judge did not recall attending the service, but did acknowledge, remember it was 2 years before or so, did acknowledge that the synagogue where the service was held was not his synagogue. That's a common Jewish thing, right? No, but he really meant, you know, this is a real case, folks. This happened in Denver. I was the law clerk to the judge, okay? He did not go to that synagogue regularly. So if he was there, he's not sure why he was there, but he didn't remember being there, okay? It was not his regular place of Shabbat worship. Should the judge be qualified, they filed a motion here, should the judge be qualified under that statute I gave you the context of earlier, or should he recuse under the Federal Code of Judicial Conduct? What other facts you need to know? Any other facts you need to know?
Is the other side Jewish?
The
other side of the
case
Jewish?
The plaintiff.
No, the plaintiff was not. I don't think he was. Why?
Well,
he was from Florida.
Did he even know the family of the bar mitzvah?
The judge?
The judge. He came to the
we knew the family.
Was he a family friend, or was he an invitee?
Okay, good question.
Can I just add 2 cents to that question?
Sure.
Was he an invitee by etiquette, or because he's a family friend? You know, is he a colleague at work, he had to invite him, but not the...
The judge did not attend anything other than the Shabbat service, okay? Did not go to the party, does not recall having an invitation, but the plaintiff alleged, the plaintiff alleged, but he was at the Shabbat service. And he wasn't normally at that show. So maybe he went and maybe he didn't. What do you think, John?
I think simply by his going to the service would not indicate any kind of prejudice.
Being present at the bar mitzvah service would not indicate any kind of bias in favor of the bar mitzvah family. Mindy?
Yeah, no, I agree.
Anybody have the other view? You took a view pretty strict.
That's slightly different.
Because it's the bar mitzvah.
No.
Bar mitzvah. I'm sorry. No, go ahead. I didn't have that.
You walk into a church service, 1,000 people, doesn't mean you know everybody. You have a relationship with everybody.
But remember,
going too far.
He was at, I'll be honest with you, the bar mitzvah was at the Alliance, okay? The judge went to Rodef. He didn't normally go to the Alliance, okay? But they said he was there, and he couldn't figure out why he was there.
Did he give the bar mitzvah boy
a gift?
Did he have
no lid? No. Not that he could remember, okay?
Was there a hot or cold kiddush?
It was what?
Was there a hot or cold kiddush?
Are you lying? Are you kidding? How can you ask?
So I think that there probably is not any actual bias, but I think once this motion has been raised, now I'd be actually worried as the judge, I'd be worried that I would actually have the opposite bias. That I'd be so concerned about the appearance of bias that I would now be concerned that I would actually hold the other side.
Because the motion was filed, and the motion, you would say the motion was did not have merit, the judge might have a bias against, well, that's always...
Not that I'd have a bias against the person who filed the motion, but now that, but sort of like the coach's son problem.
We'll swing,
you know,
the other way.
Uh-huh. Like now that the motion's filed, now I'm reminded that I was at that, and I was probably there, and whatever, now I might be concerned that I would actually judge even too harshly, because I've...
Bend over backwards to be against...
Bend over backwards to show that I wasn't biased.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that would
Good one. Yes, Rabbi.
I'm not arguing the other way. I want to make the thing two cases that may be relevant is that in the first case, during this actual argument, this person has a
active the game with other parties to a reason to want to protect his own interests. Versus in the case of the bar mitzvah, at the time that he was at the bar mitzvah, but at that moment there was no active case going on, so that interaction is not, it might creep up, but it's not actively playing a role during the actual case.
But again, remember, the issue is, does the judge sitting on a case with a family where he attends the bar mitzvah of the son have an appearance of impropriety to the, in the eyes of the public, let's say? Okay.
No.
No.
It seems, yes. It seems to me, this is what the guy's really saying, what the plaintiff is really saying. The judge is Jewish, defendant's Jewish.
We, that's the way to read it. Okay. Yes,
I know. It's the appearance of,
you're changing your mind now.
I did change my mind.
Changing your mind. Judge, not easy to be a judge. We get it. All right. Any other comments before we move on? This is a real case. The judge did not recuse himself, but I will tell you the motion was filed, what did I say, about a week before the trial, so it was a little bit of a impracticality, which you can take into account when deciding these things, but the judge felt that he just did not know the family well enough to recuse himself. By the way, the upside of the trial was a big verdict against the Jewish family. So the plaintiff had nothing to worry about. Okay, let's go to one last case. Again, these are real cases, folks. This is a related case. This is me. This just happened, okay? I was one of three judges about to hear oral argument in a case. You know, our court hears oral argument. We don't take evidence, not trials, but the lawyers come in, they present their case, it's on appeal. We were about to hear oral argument. The case was against the city of Denver. The city of Denver is represented by the Denver city attorney. The morning of oral argument, we get a motion from the attorney for the plaintiff. Now, this is a guy who has a dispute with the city of Denver. We get a motion from the attorney for the plaintiff. Moves to recuse the judge. Me. Because the attorney said, the attorney received notice that the assistant city attorney, now this guy who's going to argue the case for the city, has a personal relationship with Judge Richmond. Okay? This is real case. Got it? He found out that the attorney who's going to come argue the case has a personal relationship with Judge Richmond. And he makes a motion the morning of oral argument. Okay? This is the relationship. The appellate judge, me, once worked with the assistant attorney's late father. Okay? Gave a eulogy at the father's funeral. If you guys are pretty good, you can put two and two together, right? Gave a eulogy at the father's funeral and maintained a close relationship with the widow and the family of the late judge for whom he worked. Should the appellate judge recuse himself under the Colorado Code of Judicial Conduct? Mr. Kapnick.
Yes.
Why?
Because it certainly appears to me that you have a relationship with one of the people arguing. Therefore, you might ask easier questions, harder questions. I have fed that attorney questions before, as a journalist might do. A journalist who's spoken to you before might have had a question. And so it appears that you might rule in favor, not for the city, but for the attorney.
Okay. But when you come before me, do I recuse myself?
That's when I don't come before you.
Well, you could.
Well, I thought we had an agreement that I misunderstood. I'm trying to get a case.
No, I'm actually, that was an open-ended question. I'm not disagreeing with you. I do this. Okay, any other comments? Anybody think you should not? Any other comments?
Does the judge sound like it was timely, though? I mean,
it was pretty late, wasn't it? It was. So the defense of this guy, the city attorney had only made his, the assistant city attorney only made his notice that he was going to oral argue like a week or 6 or 7 days before the oral argument, okay? Why did the lawyer wait till the very morning of trial to make this motion? I'll tell you the reason. He was researching the heck out of me. And he found out I had given his eulogy at the funeral. He found out all this stuff. I don't, you know, he didn't know it until it was a really good motion. I mean, he had all this detail in there. In fact, it was very flattering about my close relationship with the family of the late judge. You know, I said, this is not really nice. So what should I do? Should I recuse myself?
Yes.
Why? You have to give a reason.
Oh, yeah.
That's how judges work. Once in a while, we give reasons.
I didn't realize I said that out loud. The relationship is too close. And you said, I was wondering why you didn't recuse yourself when you
I found out that morning when I was having breakfast that there was a motion filed to recuse myself, and so-and-so was going to argue the case in front of me. Okay? I'll tell you in a minute what we did, but let's hear more from
But
me.
you knew as soon as the city attorney said he was going to be arguing the case. You knew who he was.
No, I didn't know that.
You didn't know.
But he filed his notice of appearance. You know, there's an electronic filing.
So
they don't
know.
Send all the electronic filings up to us. No, I did not know that that morning. Jerry?
No, I'm not.
So, anybody else? Anybody else? All right. In this case, the judge recused himself that morning. And I'll tell you, it was a balagan because we had to get another judge to come and sit in like 45 minutes. But we had a senior judge around. He said, I'll do it. And we ended up having three judges for the case. But I felt, because I did know the city attorney, I had to recuse myself. That is a very tough issue. I've been in practice in Denver for, I've been in practice for 30 more or plus years when I became a judge. And I see we get these sheets every once in a while, who's on the case. And, oh, I know that lawyer. You know, I had a trial with him in
1985. You know a lot of lawyers.
I know a lot of lawyers.
You know a lot of city people.
Right.
How does that all about work?
Right. How do I decide when to say I can't sit on this case and when do I have to sit on this case? And it's not that easy. Steve Kavanagh is right. I do not sit on Steve Kavanagh's cases. We have too close a relationship. We do too many things outside the court together, okay? But there are other people that probably this room that I don't know that well, but they're here in this room, and I would not know to recuse myself in that case. It's a tough rule. How do you do it? Chuck?
So why wouldn't you always disqualify yourself?
From every single case
every
where I reckon...
Every time somebody says, it looks inappropriate to me.
Oh, if there was a motion?
I mean, what happens if you don't recuse yourself? There's no consequence.
Right. Well, why isn't there a consequence?
Well, I suppose there's an appellate issue beyond your... It's very hard to enforce this rule that says you should have disqualified yourself. Surely it's a discretionary.
Oh no, I think you get overturned. It's a real mess if I shouldn't. Yeah, that's a mess. No, you're right. You should err. You're saying I should err in the favor of recusing myself whenever a motion is made, and I tend to agree with you. Yes, assuming there's a basis for it. But I also have to consider recusing just when I see these advance sheets that say such and such a lawyer is going to come and argue the case. And we look at those things every Thursday, you know, we get 30 or 40 or 50 of those, and we have to decide, are we going to sit on the case, or do we recuse ourselves?
Well,
and our court...
Why would you not recuse yourself on the case? That lawyer, the person who filed the motion, did a lot of research to get you moved, but I'm not buying was only because he felt in my, that you could be impartial. He wanted you as a judge to be...
Yes.
Not just for the little reason that you know the person.
No, it wasn't. I know the person, and therefore there'd be an appearance.
Why would he research that so much?
Right.
Why would he work on that so much?
Actually, I don't think so. Because I don't know. I didn't know him. I didn't know. I hardly knew what the case was about. You know, it was.
Why would the one filing the motion work so hard to find out that information?
Jerry.
Works so hard because they have to state facts. They can't just make allegations that are conclusory.
Right, right.
If they're just conclusory allegations, the motion should be denied.
Right.
So they have to present facts that, again, a reasonable person would look at and say, okay, because of those facts, I think there's an appearance of impropriety. And we do see detailed motions. We don't see the motions too often. But the detailed motions, I mean, I've never gotten the impression that it's because somebody doesn't want me because of, I don't know, philosophical reasons of being on the case. I've never gotten that impression. But we can't grant all the motions getting back to what somebody said because we have a duty to decide.
Right, right. We have a correlated duty. We have to stay on the case.
Yeah, we have to stay on the case because we can't just shift our work onto some other judge. So we do have to make these difficult calls. Sometimes they're hard. But we tend to over-recuse on our court because we have 22 judges.
Right.
Somebody else can
consider my case. The U.S. Supreme Court can't do that. They can't do that. And that's one of the points Justice Roberts makes in his little speech there. Chuck.
I just wanted to respond to your question. I think the reason that people file these three motions is because we have to answer to our clients. So if you lose a case, particularly if you think you got it, losing a case, have your client say, well, hey, why did you let that judge sit on the case? He was obviously biased. So that's a reason, not because you don't agree that Judge Richmond is on the right or left of your problem. It's because you got to answer your client.
Thank you. That's a good point.
All right.
I think I've overstayed my welcome. Thank you all. And I'm going to let Judge Fleischer take it from
there. Judge Fleischer. Rabbi.
Rabbi and Judge Fleischer. Okay.
Boy, I just got another hat put on my head over here. All right. Thank you very much, Judge Richmond. So I'd like to take a similar approach to what Judge Richmond did, and that is to lay down some of the Torah principles over here, and then we'll go back to the three cases. And see, is that going to explode or what?
Okay.
Do
you want me to leave it on?
No, I mean, you can leave it on. I would like to go back to the cases after. Okay. But whatever works. Or we just go back to the paper. Either way. Okay, so if you look at your source sheets over here, when we look at the Torah, we're looking at the source of everything. The Talmud tells us that before God created the world, the Torah existed, and God looked into the Torah, in fact, in order to create the world, the Torah, in a sense, is the blueprint. And so we're looking at wisdom over here in the Torah that really predates the creation of the world, and hence everything that we have in the world really is predicated on that. So let's see what the Torah has to tell us, and the sages of the Torah who have that tradition from Sinai, what they had to say about some of these questions. We start with the pasuk that the verse that Judge Richmond mentioned. I'm just quoting one of them over here. You shall not respect someone's presence, and you shall not take a bribe, for the bribe will blind the eyes of the wise and make just words crooked. Okay? And that's the verse that was mentioned earlier. So the great biblical commentator Rashi says on that, a warning to the judge that he not be gentle to this one and harsh to this one. In other words, everyone has to be treated equally. Justice is blind, as it were, before the eyes of the law. For when he sees the judge honoring his opponent, if one litigant sees the judge honoring his opponent, the claims will be obstructed. He's going to clam up, he'll get nervous. And so here we have in the Torah itself an obligation for a judge not to show any sort of favoritism whatsoever. You can't have one sit and one stand, and so on and so forth. So much so that if you look at source 2, in one of the commentators on the Torah, he says that I heard from a colleague of his, Rabbi Moshe Berdugo, that as a judge, he was careful at the time of judges that his eyes be cast downward. He wouldn't lift his eyes at all. He wouldn't even look at the litigants. Okay, so the next best thing to a blindfold. He wouldn't look at them at all. And he said, this is the fulfillment of what it says, listen between your brothers. The verse states, listen. And he took that as an indication, allusion, just to listen, but not to look. That they do nothing but listen, and the words come from the litigants before them without any variations in the treatment towards the litigants. Okay, and that's just right off the bat, basic conduct of the judge in the courtroom. Okay, that is as far as showing favoritism. What about the bribe issue? So, as Judge Richmond alluded to earlier, there is a very, very fascinating passage in Source 3 where the great Talmudic sage Rava says, what is the reason against taking a bribe? For when one receives a bribe from him, the judge now becomes like the litigant himself. And a person does not see wrong in himself. Because this person gave you something, you are now connected, and you become, in a sense, connected to that individual, almost as one. And he says the word shochad in Hebrew, shochad means a bribe, is an acronym for shehu chad, which means, and he is one, that it is one. Is a unification process that occurs between the giver of the bribe and the recipient of the bribe, and hence you have the Hebrew word shochad is a combination of those two words, shehu chad, that it is one. And that's the idea of, says Rava, the idea behind the bribe. Practically speaking, how far does the bribe go? Obviously, any sort of financial bribe or anything like that is forbidden. But how far does a bribe go? So, if you look at source number 4, so the Talmud, again, quotes the verse, a bribe you shall not take. It is not necessary to say a monetary bribe. That's obvious. But rather, even a bribe of words is also forbidden. What's a bribe of words? The Talmud gives a number of cases. I've quoted one of them over here. The Talmud says the case of Shmuel. Shmuel was a judge in Babylonia during the Talmudic era. A certain man came and gave him his hand for him as he crossed the bridge to give him support. this wasn't the Verrazano bridge he was crossing. This was probably a narrow rope bridge or something to that effect. And the man stuck out his hand to give him some support. Shmuel said, what is your business here? Apparently he didn't know the fellow, didn't recognize him. What are you doing in town? He said, I am here for a lawsuit. And Shmuel said, well, you just disqualified me to be your judge. Because you gave me a hand, so now I cannot be your judge. And the Talmud gives several other illustrations. The Talmud gives a case of where a judge was approaching the court case, and there was some dirt or something unpleasant on the floor, and ahead of him a man covered it for him so that he did not have to pass by it or see it and so on to hide the judge from the unpleasant item that was on the floor. And he asked the man again, what are you doing over here? I don't know you. And he said, I'm here for a case, but I can't judge you. Another judge, a man whom he did not know, removed a feather from his hat. Usually we want to have feathers in our caps, but in this case it was taken off. And again, the man said, I'm here for a case to come before your court. And he said, you just disqualified me. So these are some of the cases the Talmud gives. And these are examples of what's called a bribe of words. It's not limited to verbal, although it's clear that even if, just how far this goes, how careful a judge has to be. In the code of Jewish law, it says that if a person gives you a shalom, and he greets you when he would not normally do so, and he greeted you in a fashion or in a way that it was not normally accustomed to doing so, that may be sufficient to disqualify the judge, because that's a bribe of words. He has greeted you in a more pleasant or expansive fashion than he's usually accustomed to, and that's enough. Okay? Now, the question becomes, let's just assume we have one of these cases, and we'll get back to these three cases shortly. Let's assume we have a case where the judge went ahead and he received one of these types of subtle favors, if you will, and he's now sitting on the case. Is he obligated to recuse himself? So, if you look at source number 5, the Talmudic commentator, Tosfos, say that on these cases, he says that these sages distance himself, but the law does not render him invalid. And similarly, the cases such as where he brought him the basket of fruits, he's alluding to one of the illustrations in the Talmud where a sharecropper would bring the fruits to the owner of the land every Friday. And one week he showed up on Thursday. And so the judge said, why are you here early? He said, I'm coming for a lawsuit, so I figured I'd bring you the fruits a day early. He said, I'm sorry, but since you brought them a day early, I can't judge your case. And so Tosfos says that this is not strictly obligatory. You don't have to recuse yourself as a judge, but rather they were careful and stringent upon themselves to go the extra mile, to be extra careful, and to recuse themselves because it may touch upon the issue of bribery. That is the opinion of Tosfos. Now, I didn't quote it here, but Maimonides is fairly clear in his, when he writes down the laws, the Rambam, Maimonides, he seems to say that, in fact, you must recuse yourself. A case like this, you must recuse yourself from the case because it already crosses into the territory of a bribe. It's a bona fide bribe, and the judge may not judge the case if he receives any of these subtle favors. How far does it go? I think, on a case-by-case basis would need to be decided. Yeah?
I just have a question. Does it work the other way around as well? Unless the guy did not extend his hand to help the judge across the bridge?
Then he would be upset at him. I'll get there in a moment. I will point out one thing that the commentators do say. When we talk about a favor, and we'll get to the case of friends or enemies in a moment, when we talk about a favor, it's a favor which is beyond the norm. Right. So in other words, if I say hello, and that's normal etiquette out here in Colorado, in case you didn't figure it out from the Verrazano code, I'm from New York, where if you say hello, it's like, everything okay? Why are you talking to me? Type of thing. But over here in Denver, it's par for the course. You wish a good morning, and that's how it should be. And in fact, our sages encourage, be nice to everyone. Say good morning, say hello, how are you? If that's the norm, that's not a favor. So if it's standard, normal etiquette for someone to do that, that wouldn't be a favor. And I think the flip side as well, what would the expectation be? But let's look at source number 6, and that is that Rav Papa, the Talmudic sage Rav Papa said, a man should judge neither one whom he likes, nor one whom he dislikes. He will not see wrong in one whom he likes, and he will not see merit in one whom he dislikes. Okay, that's obviously a bit of a stereotypical statement, but in a general sense, the idea that you may favor one whom you are close with, and you may disfavor someone whom you're not close with. And so I guess the question would be, if it's expected, would we expect that he stick out his hand? Of course, once it's expected, he wouldn't have been disqualified on the flip side, because that's normal then. If it's normal, standard protocol, that if someone's crossing the bridge, you stick out your hand to help them across, and he really wasn't doing him a favor beyond the norm, he wouldn't have had to remove himself from the case. Okay? So a friend or an enemy, and friend or enemy here doesn't mean best friends forever, and it doesn't mean sworn enemy whom you can't stand the sight of. Okay? A lot of the commentators say that even someone who is a mild friend perhaps, a colleague, would be sufficient if you're somewhat partial towards that individual. And an enemy would be even someone, not a sworn enemy per se, whom you can't stand the sight of, but someone whom you perhaps don't get along that well with or don't like that much. So much so that again, the code of Jewish law says if you have two Torah scholars who argue with each other a lot and always disagree, they can't sit on the same court together, on the same court case, because they're predisposed to disagree with each other. And he just, whatever he says, I say the opposite. And so they can't, because of that, it's not necessarily a dislike, but just a predisposition that if you say apples, I'm going to say oranges. If you say I'm going to say B, and therefore it would even potentially go that far. Okay? Now, that's, again, as far as the idea of bribes, the idea of friends and enemies. What about where the judge has a potential vested interest in the case? So that brings us to source number 7. Any matter in which the judge has an element of benefit, he is unable to judge that case. Therefore, city members whose Torah scroll was stolen, and we're talking about where this is the sole Torah scroll available in that locale, may not have the case judged by the judges of that city unless they have another Torah scroll. Because I go to synagogue every Shabbos, and I'm relying on that Torah scroll. So because we are now judging the legal situation, the legal law of that Torah scroll, the judge, he's relying on a Torah scroll. Come Shabbos, he is going to have a vested interest in the case that he wants that Torah scroll restored to the synagogue. If there are other Torah scrolls in the synagogue, and they talk about, let's say there's another synagogue where he does not go, he could potentially go. Would that be sufficient? He could go there, or he won't go there. This where the discussion starts. How far does this go? You know, without getting into all the details, but these are some of the questions that are raised by the commentators. But certainly, if that's the only Torah scroll available where he lives, he can't judge because he has a vested interest in the case. Look at source number 8. Just how far this go? How far this goes? Neither a king nor a high priest in the temple may be part of the deliberations to intercalate a year. Okay, because when they would determine the intercalation of the year is that every second or third year on the Jewish calendar, an extra month is added in order to allow the lunar calendar of the Jewish calendar to maintain pace with the solar calendar. Okay, so just this past year we had one. In case you noticed, the holidays came out very late this year, although from the weather outside you would never know it, but it came out because last year was a leap year. Now, when today, because we don't have that body of 71 judges known as the Sanhedrin, which you might call the Supreme Court of the Jewish people. So we have a set calendar that was put into place centuries ago, millennia ago. But back in the day, when they had that body of judges, they would make the decision, A, when to call Rosh Chodesh the new month, and when to create a leap year not one day, but an entire extra month. Neither a king nor a high priest can be on that body because they have an interest. A king because of wages of the army, because he pays annually. And so if there's an extra month, he has an extra month of not to have to pay the soldiers.
13 months for 12 months of pay.
Yeah,
13 months of labor for 12 months of pay.
Correct.
Baker's dozen.
King's dozen. In this case, King's dozen. And a high priest, because of the cold, there is some discussion what cold means, but basically, on Yom Kippur, which comes out September, October, when the seasons are just changing, the high priest would have to perform the service in the temple over the course of the entire Yom Kippur. He's fasting, and he has to basically run back and forth doing all sorts of complicated procedures that are heavy and difficult, and he had to do it barefoot. If it's earlier, it's warmer. If it's later, it's colder. as I mentioned, maybe not this year, but in a general sense. So he has a vested interest in there not being a leap year, so that Yom Kippur fall earlier on the calendar, and thus the floor is not quite as cold. Other commentators say because he had to immerse himself so many times during the course of the service, that water could be mighty cold also. So if it's earlier, it's a lot easier. If it's later, it will be more difficult. That's enough of a vested interest to disqualify them from being judges on that case. So you see the idea that even what may be perceived as a fairly minor interest may well be sufficient to invalidate a person from judging on a case. Okay, those are the basic, again, some of the basic ideas. Again, there's a ton of discussion, endless discussion on all the nitty-gritty and back and forth and all the different scenarios and so on that come up, but this is just a basic background of some of the issues. One more source, and then I want to show you the last source will be on a separate issue, but one more source, source number 9. The Talmud over here says, and I will just speak it out outside, that there's a commandment in the Torah called stay, keep your nose clean. That says that you have to take steps to make sure that no one look at you and think that you are doing something improper. You have to, as it says over there, you have to remain, you know, free of any appearance of impropriety. Okay, and that's an obligation in the Torah. The Talmud tells us that there were people who would go into the temple treasury to remove money for the sacrifices and the functions of the temple. They would have to go in without any, they would have to wear garments that had no pockets, hems, seams, anywhere where they could possibly be accused of hiding money. Okay? And they couldn't even wear their tefillin, the phylacteries on the arm and the head, because one might accuse them of going in with hollow boxes on the arm and head, opening them up, putting the money inside, and walking back out. Now, that might be a great way to smuggle stuff into the country. In fact, there are stories of untrained airport personnel taking apart tefillin boxes to make sure that nothing is inside. Always good to have those training courses for them. But these are okay. Anyway, yeah. But you see again the idea that this is not just for a judge. This is true in general. This is true in a general sense that a person has to conduct himself or herself in a way where people cannot look at them askance and say this person is doing something wrong. Okay, and certainly that would apply to a judge as well, where there could be that appearance. Before I get to the cases, I just want to show you one more source here, which I think connects very much to Justice Bader Ginsburg's situation, the question of whether when she made her statements about a certain political candidate, whether not only was it the proper thing to do initially, but could that potentially invalidate her from a future case according to Torah law. So there's a very, very interesting passage. There's a lot of background to this that I don't have time to go into. But in the land of Israel, around the late 15th century, there was a back and forth between the Torah authorities in Safed, in Sfat, and the Torah authorities in Jerusalem about a certain case. It was a back and forth. And the Torah authorities in Safed said, we already convened, and we are the majority. At that time, Safed was the major enclave of the Jewish population in the land of Israel. Jerusalem was a much smaller settlement. And so the rabbi, the head rabbi in Safed said, we already convened, we made a decision, we are the majority, and therefore our ruling holds. And the main rabbi in Jerusalem said, you can only claim majority if all the judges were present and discussed and convened and discussed and then came to a decision. Because me and my colleagues here in Jerusalem weren't part of that discussion, your claim of majority is invalidated because we weren't in there. You can only make a claim of majority if everyone was in on the discussion. To which the rabbi in Safed, the judge in Safed said back, okay, come on down, we'll all sit down and we'll discuss this. And we'll still come out with the majority, but you're welcome to come down and we'll have the discussion. To which the Torah authority in Jerusalem said, not only does their decision that they decided in the past not stand based on majority rule, but even if now they would want to discuss with us in judgment and to hear our claims and to inform us of their proofs, their subsequent decision would not stand due to majority rule. This is due to the fact that they already have an interest in the case and are thus regarded as related to themselves. You can't testify on your behalf or judge on your behalf because the Torah says a relative cannot testify or judge, and you are related to yourself. That's the technical background for why you can't testify on your own behalf or judge on your own behalf. For they are ashamed to retract from what they decided originally and will not accept any claim to retract. So says this rabbi, he is known as the Maharal Bach, that's an acronym for Rabbi Levi Ben Choviv. Okay, the acronyms are a lot easier to pronounce than the whole name. But what he said was that once you convened and made a decision, you can't reconvene on the same exact case again because you already have a bias towards your previous decision. And now we have a whole lot of talk from the later commentators about how far does that go? Is that true if you just made a decision on your own or only if there were full deliberations in a court and they made a decision that was later invalidated? If the person just made an offhand comment, would that? There's a lot of talk about it back and forth. Again, as I said, this is just a basic background, but I think that would be where Justice Bader Ginsburg's comments, where they would fall in under Torah law, would be this kind of discussion where he said, once you've already decided, you can't reconvene and judge the case, the exact same case again.
We send cases back to judges all the time to decide them. Remands are called to decide them again. And this would suggest maybe the judge couldn't hear the case on remand. I don't know. It has amazing implications. Jared?
Well, we get asked to rehear cases ourselves.
We also do, right.
We issue a decision and the parties ask us to re-decide the case.
To re-decide the case again.
Yeah.
So
as this points out, it doesn't really work.
Because you've already right.
You're invested.
right. Now, obviously, when he says will not accept any claim, he's speaking a bit in terms of hyperbole. It's not never, but certainly, as you are saying, once you decide something, it takes a lot more to get a person to retract their opinion once it's been stated, rather than prior to it being formulated in the public sphere.
You're listening to something that has changed. The reason why you're not just hearing a case.
You're hearing the case, but once you've issued a statement to say, whoops, I was wrong the first time, even if maybe there's new evidence, I think still people have a hard time to go back.
The Druzin versus the Pad, the Druzin scholars felt that they've gone through the whole case properly and there's nothing new coming to the case.
Right. Okay, so you want to make that argument that perhaps if there's new evidence, maybe that would give them more leeway. Okay. Potentially. Like I said, so I'm just saying once she made her statements about a certain political candidate, let's say that, let's just say you have a repeat of the 2000 election. I sure hope we don't, boy, but God forbid. But let's just say, I can't imagine she could, I don't know that she could sit on that court. I mean, this is just the rabbi's opinion, whatever it's worth, you know. Once she's made her statements, there's a public statement of what her opinion of the fellow is, who she would prefer to be president.
It would put the number 7 if she recuses herself.
Yeah, well,
the number 7, not 8.
So I'd like to, the few minutes we have over here, I'd just like to go back to the three cases and to judge these cases based on the Torah law. Going back to case number 1 of the AT&T case. 2 points over here. Point number 1 is certainly one can invoke, as you said, the appearance of impropriety, as the Torah says, you shall keep yourselves clean, are the words used in the Torah, and above any sort of, and again, it's a judgment call, like you said, from case to case, by the judge, what point will people start to whisper, talk about it, and so on. There's another issue over here that comes up in this case, and which I didn't mention in the sources, and that there's an idea in Jewish law called Baal Dover. Baal Dover means, I am a litigant in the case. Okay, and here the question becomes, if I own stock in AT&T, in a sense, AT&T is what would you call a Baal Dover? They are directly involved in this case. If I own stock in AT&T, does that now make me, as the judge, one of the litigants, or to some degree, one of the people who are not just affected by the case, but directly part and parcel of the case? This gets into a very big discussion of what the Torah view of corporations and stockholding are. Are you really an owner? Are you not? Are corporations a person or not? I'm not going there.
The Torah?
Maybe,
yeah. The Torah?
There are actually, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who passed away in 1986 based on many Torah sources, has a very lengthy discussion about it. What is the status of one who owns stock in a company? Just as one example, you're not allowed to own chametz, leavened bread, over Passover. If I own stock in a bread company, do I have to sell my stocks before Passover? Or I own 20 stocks in, Udi's, whatever it may be. So, you know, do I have to sell them? Or I'm not really an ownership. I just have the stocks. That's a big discussion. But let's just assume for a moment that you are an owner. The argument would certainly be very strong that in this case, the person by owning stock is an owner. He's directly involved in the case. And that may well invalidate it. If you say owning a few hundred stocks doesn't make me an owner, then, you know, it's just a question of appearance, of impropriety. To case number two. Okay? And here we have, again, the same question. Appearance of impropriety would come into play over here in the Torah law, just as in standard American law. There would be another question, as I asked Judge Richmond before. Let's assume for a moment that the judge was invited. As I mentioned before, in terms of I did you a favor, I took the feather off your cap, I gave you a hand, I invited you to my son's bar mitzvah. Is that as a friend? Well, then you're a friend. I can't judge you if you're a close friend. Or is it just, well, I invited everyone in the office, so I wasn't going to leave you out, but I really don't have very much to do with you. That's just etiquette, part of the course. It's normal when you make a bar mitzvah, you invite everyone in the office, I really don't have very much to do with you, so I didn't really do you any sort of favor. That's normal. That's like giving a hand when it's expected. Then, I don't think you would have a problem in terms of the bribe of words, to go back to that Talmudic term, because it's normal, it's part of the course of standard. Certainly, if the judge himself knows that he doesn't know, he has no memory of the whole thing, he goes to so many bar mitzvahs every week, and so on and so forth, that he just can't recall all these things, then the argument could certainly be made that there is no favoritism at this point. He doesn't recall. Of course, once someone points it out, you could say, well, now he appreciates it again. There are some sources that indicate that this idea of a favor, a bribe of words, is only when it occurred right around the case, where the person did it because he's coming for the case. But if it happened 2 years ago, it doesn't seem like that is the standard opinion, but there is such an opinion out there. It just happened. I gave the guy a hand on the bridge 2 years ago. I'm validated now. Or no, he came for the lawsuit. That's the wording in the Talmud. I'm coming for a lawsuit, and now I'm going to give you a hand. That may be more of an issue. But again, this doesn't seem to be the standard opinion, but that is one opinion that is out there. And that brings us to the last case, and then we have a couple minutes left for any discussion. The last case over here, I think, in my humble opinion, for whatever it's worth, that this is pretty clear a case of a friend. It's a family friend. Besides the fact that he, you know, I don't know that that delivering a eulogy at the funeral may be considered construed as a favor. Perhaps here it's the other way around, where the judge did a favor for the litigant or for the attorney. But if you're a friend and you have a close relationship with the family, that should certainly be grounds to invalidate the judge. Now, there is talk in the commentators when a judge goes ahead and judges a case where there's a family friend, not a friend, or an enemy, after the fact, does the case get thrown out, or is it valid after the fact? In other words, is it just initially he's obligated to recuse a bribe, the case is gone. If he accepted a bribe, the case is totally invalid. What about if he judges a friend or an enemy, so initially he's supposed to avoid it and to recuse himself? What if he judged after the fact, does the case become invalidated, or is it valid? That is, again, discussion among the various commentators on that issue. Okay, so that is based on the principles we saw, I think, just from my view, how the Torah would view these cases.
Questions? Quick questions.
I have a question. Is there a lovely panel legal application regarding the bribe against the judgment? Meaning, you know, the Thomas case you say is the guy's going to low, and that will affect a case. In law, is there a difference between like hello or a playing golf with the guy every week versus also what the decision would be? Like how big was this? Is there a difference in the knowledge versus the amount of, you know, not being clear?
You want to know if he plays golf every week, is that a lot worse than just getting a hello?
Yes. Yeah. Because in Talmud it doesn't seem that way.
Well, the Talmud is giving the extreme cases. In fact, there are commentators that say that the reason why a friend or an enemy, that the reason why a bribe of words is invalidates the judge is because he now becomes a friend. So there are sources that say that he now becomes a friend because he did this small favor for him. So it really boils down to the friend issue and not so much the bribe of words. There are some sources that say that. If he plays golf, I think he's a friend, unless they're always fighting over it. I don't know.
Okay, folks, my understanding is there are sheets for those who need CLE for the course at the front desk. Is that correct?
Yes.
So make sure you grab them, fill them in. We want to thank the judge, his law clerk, his colleagues. This was an exceptional presentation. And of course, Rabbi Fleischer, who
thank
is
you,
an expert on every subject.
Thank you very much.